doing a double section of tours today, just 6 to 6:55, and then that means Friday we don't have tours. All right, so just a heads up about to help you work through the reading for negligent infliction of emotional distress. Remember, we're still kind of building it off of the basic concept of negligence, so you want to think about where it differs from that, you know, the emphasis on the injury there because it's emotional distress as opposed to typical physical injuries. What do you have to show to get recovery? The biggest problem with NIED, truthfully, is the bystander claims. We'll mention them a little bit today because you see them in intentional infliction of emotional stress claims too. But the bystander claims in NIED are the big dispute. And a lot of jurisdictions have very different approaches, and we're going to learn all those that have influenced a lot of law between Ohio and also across the country. So that's where most of the controversy is negligent infliction, bystander injury. So focus on that, if anything, for Monday. Today we're going to finish up intentional infliction of emotional distress, and I put the elements back on the board. We're going to talk a little bit about our case that we have for today, but we're also going to spend some of our hour here working on a legal skill that is interviewing and client counseling, and we'll work on a real-life case and use it in that kind of scenario. So we're going to talk about that. The case today is actually an unusual one, and if I was the casebook author, I probably wouldn't have selected this. The main reason is it really is very, very, very early in the lawsuit. It's a motion to dismiss, so all you're looking at is the pleadings, which means there's no evidence whatsoever. So the judge is really, under the procedural rules, when you get to CivPro next year, you'll focus on this, is really disinclined to get rid of anything. If you can just take what they've stated, the person who's trying to present the claim, take it in their favor, like if they could prove all that, would they have a claim? Why it's not so great for torts is it doesn't really answer then, under these facts, does that amount to an intentional infliction of emotional distress? Because that's not the issue before the court. All that's before the court really is, can this survive that motion to dismiss? Which is why they say, oh, we should let a jury really get to hear this. So that's how we're working on something else as well today, because it's just not the greatest case in the world, but we'll work with it. All right. So like our other intentional torts, we need to still find some sort of basis of intention, or as we're going to see with IIED, we're going to potentially look into reckless conduct. All right. We discussed extreme and outrageous. We discussed severe emotional distress. We'll review those. But let's talk about the intent element first. All right. So we know what intent is from our other intentional torts, and it's the same for IIED. If you're going to prove intent, it's either purpose or desire or knowledge with substantial certainty. Okay. Purpose or desire or knowledge with substantial certainty. The twist we get is that we also have the capacity for this tort to use recklessness as the basis for our conduct. And if you remember from the punitive damages we discussed in the first couple weeks, we defined recklessness. Remember, like the deliberate indifference, conscious disregard. These kinds of claims typically are in the flavor of the reckless disregard. So if you think about it, it's like the driver, the trucker going down the hill and sees all that and just decides anyway. That's the kind of recklessness we're talking about. All right, so let's deal with what happened in this case and work out our elements and see where we get. All right, what was the actual factual underpinnings of the 164 Mulberry? And you may wonder why it's that. The business that was the header, the named plaintiff in this dispute, was doing business as 164 Mulberry, so they don't have their restaurant in the title, but that's why, just in case you're wondering. But let's talk about what happened here. What was the alleged conduct against the restaurateurs? Yeah?
This case looks like it was a researcher at Columbia University who was sending out letters to these restaurant owners alleging that he or some persona is that he was inventing, essentially, contracted food poisoning from that restaurant. Knowing full well that, you know, food poisoning claim is going to give these restaurants, of course, all kinds of bad publicity. It could end up them losing their business or losing a whole bunch of prestige, a whole bunch of their reputation. So this is causing these people a lot of problems.
Okay. So he sends the same letter to multiple people. He's not, it's what's not clear at this point, because remember, we're still at the complaint phase. The defendants allege that he also was the reason behind the notification to a third party, to the Department of Health, which came in and did some investigations. And we don't know where that's going to go, because we don't have the trial yet. We're really early on. But that's the basis of their libel claims, their slander claims, and how other people know this falsehood and it causes bad reputation against you. We will, at the very, very end of this semester, get into slander and libel and privacy torts. But for now, just realize there's other things going on in this lawsuit. So one issue for the court is, do we even need an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim when you can really recover for a lot of the injury here under torts we know, like privacy torts, which we'll get to. In this kind of what he did, the professor here, he uses his pseudonym because he's really trying to gather information about how people respond when they receive customer complaints like this. So what do you think about the intention level here, since we're talking about the intent or recklessness piece? If you were to show, let's look at just intention. Do you believe he had the purpose or desire in his behavior to cause severe emotional distress amongst the restaurateurs? Do you think that was his purpose, his desire? What would you argue? You say no? Why not? Okay. Okay, well, remember, we don't want to conflate motivation with purpose. Remember, purpose is like, this is the result I want, but the motivation, if it's for science or is it for advancing my career, is not intention. Remember, so to keep those kind of things constant. But what was your desire to have happen from this conduct? Did you desire them to have severe emotional distress? I don't think so. I mean, I really think that's a very hard thing to suggest, that when he sent this, that was his purpose. We have no kind of evidence to suggest that's what his desire was in his conduct. Knowledge with substantial certainty. Remember, this is like you're almost to a near certainty know that that's what's going to happen when you send them the letter. Would you say that, like, to a near certainty, he'd know that they'd suffer this emotional distress when he sent the letter? What do you think? Okay, why not? Yeah, that's kind of, if you think about fault behavior, falls short, I think, of what we normally think about with respect to intention, because it's certainly not his purpose. And arguably, he doesn't get to that level of knowledge to near certainty that that's what's going to happen. Yes?
I was a bit confused about the court's holding on potential infliction of emotional distress. It sounded like they didn't affirm it, but they just allowed it.
That's because all we have before us is a motion to dismiss. So there is nothing to affirm. There's just a complaint filed, and you have to ask yourself, on the facts of alleged in this complaint, would this be enough to create a lawsuit?
It's pretty absurd. Like, one example they gave of a French chef, and it's
well, and I think the court's using a lot of latitude here because realize they're not actually deciding whether, in fact, this is outrageous or, in fact, that they did suffer severe emotional distress or even that this was the intention or not. But on the facts as alleged, could a jury potentially find this? And that's all we're saying is we can allow it to go to a jury to decide. They're not saying this is why it could go on to case reports, great for Civ Pro, not so much reports because it doesn't really tell us in the end. You know, what did a jury determine, and do we think that's a fact, severe, and outrageous? I think the casebook author put this in here because there isn't a lot of published material on this, since these claims tend to get subsumed by other intentional torts. A lot of jurisdictions don't let you use these claims unless you have a true gap filler. Remember Dickens versus Courier? You know, he had that last bit that wasn't assault, wasn't battered. It's the guy who got beaten, said, take your phone off the wall and leave, or we're going to kill you. Yeah, that last bit was all he had left, and there was no other claim for it to allow IAP. So that's kind of why he stuck with this one. Plus, I think he went to the debate period.
Why didn't
Torsten
allow IAP to be used as a catch-all?
It's not used as a catch-all. It's used for when we really think that there is something to recover. It's just that it doesn't fall within the strictures of battery assault. Like, I think Dickens is a better one to visualize. That last threat isn't an assault, but it sure seems like it should be actionable. And if you think about it, most courts keep it out based on the extreme and outrageous conduct.
That's why they also sue for those things. And so the question is, when we get there, whether or not they're going to have those claims. And they say, since for one party, those claims are going to survive, and they dismiss the IID claim because he has libel slander claims against him. The other guy, he doesn't have slander claims against. His claim on IID can go to the jury, or at least go forward. We're even close to the jury. We're really just at, you file your pleadings at the court. They file an answer or decide this time to move to just dismiss based on paper. At the beginning, you haven't stated enough. So we're really not into the part where we can really get, with this case, those questions answered for us. We're just at the, we're not going to shut the door on these people right now. But they did with respect to the ones who could show a libel claim. They said, oh, we don't need the gap filler. All right, so back to the whether or not this could be knowledge of substantial certainty. I don't think even here you'd have knowledge with, like, near certainty that this would cause emotional distress. You really do need sort of the softening that we see in IID of reckless disregard. So how could you argue that this individual evidenced reckless disregard with respect to the emotional well-being, or with respect to the fact that emotional distress might flow from his activity? Could you argue that, at least enough to get past this initial hurdle? You're not in your head, yes, yeah, why?
What would you do if somebody would claim that it's an experiment, just random thrusters, he portrayed himself as a customer who obtained, which has a total different response than saying, what would your process be, what would you try to do to offset it, or what would you be thinking, things like that.
And why was that so reckless? I mean, really, what is it about the situation that makes it so reckless? Like, what if we just had someone come up to the building security and said, I'm a student here, and I just slipped and fell on the icy patch out front. Do you think we'd have, oh, it's an experiment run by the SBA to see the security guards we're going to do, and now we have reckless disregard with respect to the emotional distress level of all the officers here at the school. What's different about it? Yeah.
One slip from the school, it's not going to shut down the school, whereas one out of the boys in the restaurant,
okay. Yep. Did you want to answer that?
Yeah. I just wanted to ask. There's going to be a lot of potential harm. I thought about doing something about having to test every single employee to see if they feel the worst of the poisoning, and sometimes that will actually blacklist employees. That's a lot of harm about the poisoning.
Do you
want to
get it?
I was
going to
say, like, you can foresee that something may come from that, like, whoever was responsible for the assault animal on the ice, or whoever's responsible for the case, could be fired for business and foreseeable.
So is it just being foreseeable enough? Because that sounds like negligence, right? That was a foreseeable risk. And that's not exactly what we have. What is it about the level of foreseeability, do you think? The potential emotional stress? Like, really highly perceivable in the situation as opposed to emotional stress suffered by capital when they know he's going to fall. And don't get me wrong, we'd be really upset about that. But it's just, you know, I think that the distress level here, the entire business could crumble on one bad, you know, report like that. Because it's not just, hey, we don't like your food. It's your food has, like, foodborne illness associated with it. So they make a lot of all the facts here, and I think, like, you have to read it, and that's why they talk about those extreme cases, that it's not just like a typical business that has a threat from a customer, that the entire business is focused on their reputation, and this particular type of allegation is one that's not only, like, for the customers a problem, but for the health agencies that provide them licensure and accreditation, that is something they're likely not to come back around from. And they're in a super competitive market, and being a higher-end restaurant in New York City, where, you know, people kind of come and go on a whim. And so they're worried about that. And they also cite to a lot of actual harm they get that's not just emotional from this, that they had to, like, shred all their inventory, notify their vendors about what had happened. Who knows who told the Department of Public Health, maybe even they felt like they needed to. They had to go through all the physical testing of all the employees. They threatened their employees with firing them and blacklisting them from, you know, culinary careers. You know, it wasn't just a small, like, oh, this is going to cause us some potential liability or cause us a problem. And it is because the specificness of the situation, of the circumstances we find our plaintiffs in, that I think the court is willing to say, at this point in time, it's enough to get to the jury on reckless disregard. Is this enough to be reckless disregard? I don't know. You know, the court doesn't tell us that. We don't have the jury telling us. I don't know if a jury would look at this and say, yes, that's enough. I'll tell you, it's really hard to prove these cases. So you can even see, given all we've talked about, that a jury could reasonably come to the same conclusion and say, that's just not enough reckless disregard. It's probably negligent. But whether he was reckless when he did it, I don't know.
Should we look at those as two different elements?
Yeah.
Intent or...
Yes. And that's exactly how you should look at it, is that intention comes first. If you can show intention, that's always preferable, because it seems to be, like, you know, intentional behavior is much more culpable than reckless behavior, and so you want to stylize it that way. If for no other reason, then you'll get larger damages. But either one satisfies for IIED in some jurisdictions. Some are more specific about IIED and make it purely intentional. There's more of a trend to allow recklessness in, because I'll tell you, in practice, you normally get deemed under extreme or outrageous or severe emotional distress. So it's the, unlike our normal, our other intentional torts, intent was a big hurdle. Here, IAID, the other elements actually become a much bigger hurdle. Do you have your hand up? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, if you think about the spectrum of fault, intention, recklessness, negligence. So you're in between the two. And remember, recklessness is fuzzy by definition. It's kind of intentionally so, because we want to just use it to kind of buttress claims that are slightly weak in intent. It's really what the purpose is. All right, so that's the intent piece. Let's talk about the other ones. What about severe emotional distress? What would you say is severe about the results here? Is it just allegations of vague feelings of anxiety and upsetness, distress that your business might have some impact? No, I mean, I think the things we pointed out really show the severity. What do you think was, for you, the most compelling fact of severe, emotional stress?
Well, I think the
person who had a heart problem, psychiatric care, those kind of things are documentable as well, so that's good. Anything else that was severe? Out of all the stuff that they had to go through. Okay. What'd you find severe?
I would say that actually the employees trying to be tested and possibly fired. I mean, that being actually used to blacklist in your part. I mean, that.
Yeah, that kind of threat about your entire career. And really, those aren't our plaintiffs, but the employers, I think, having to dole that kind of a punishment out is a lot of stress when you think about, like, type of business you have and wanting to continue the working relationship with employees. Well, you can't even smoke with that, so obviously, throw out their retirement for you to make sure that's a lot of expenses. When you look at a restaurant, the margin of profit is generally not so great that it can subsume the product that much. That if you lose an entire amount of inventory and have to warn your vendors about these things, that you would be able to recoup it. So it's a real loss. Anything else people found persuasive? Yeah. Yeah, they were like in a whole hog. So if this goes under, it's not just like, oh, well, I'll just find another restaurant to open. It's pretty much everything's gone. Yeah. And then even when the health department came in, it's kind of a invasive way of testing your employees. So
yeah.
It's just
not comfortable, no. Like, I mean, it's not pleasant, and it really does kind of permeate the employment there. So it's a problem. Okay.
At least there's, if they hadn't at this point, that's arguably was likely to happen. We do know that they told their vendors, the restaurants told their vendors in some situations about what had happened, and that interrupts, like, the vendors and wanting to provide, you know, their goods to you.
Because also the relationship between the restaurants and the
Yeah, because they don't want to provide food to someone who might potentially make them liable for how the food's handled. So it was really, there's a lot of severe impact. So it seems to be that it's more than just like the note that they gave you, note three with the Chinese restaurant that had the bad food report. You know, that's not great to have someone tell you, like, you know, it was like, you know, frozen on my plate still. But it's certainly not the same level as this kind of allegation as the restaurant's longevity and likelihood. All right, what about outrageousness? Would you say, as most courts tell us what extreme and outrageous be, that you'd stand up and exclaim, outrageous, given what he did? I think how many people will be like at that level? Like outrageous, seeing like what we saw was outrageous and what wasn't last time. How many people will be in that category? This is outrageous. No. Other people say, no, this is not outrageous. Okay, so most people there, so why?
Well, he just wrote a letter saying, I just want to let you know that, you know, my other persona got food poisoning. We didn't take the other persona, but, and he said he wasn't going to take it to the health department. So I think just letting a restaurant go, I don't think, like, if you just say that, and if it's true, you're not thinking that this is, like, completely outrageous behavior. You just want the restaurant to know that, hey, maybe something's wrong.
Okay, well, it's certainly not true. So we know, like, it has to be, like, conduct when it's false, and you tell the restaurant, is that outrageous? Yeah. So it wasn't like he was taking out an ad to talk about it. He hadn't warned anybody else. Yeah. All right, well, let's think about it. And did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I try to lean a little bit more on the outrageous.
It is outrageous.
I mean, I kind of think of it as like yelling fire in the theater. It's something that you normally wouldn't do to a new set effect and it comes to mind. So I guess it's.
And you see it as like you can't really argue that the consequence panic isn't something you should have clearly been able to see.
Yeah.
All right, let's compare it to the, yeah, go ahead. Do you want to hand up, please?
Well, I kind of have something to add a question with it. So, I was kind of on the fence too about saying this. It's probably not really outrageous, because I don't think it's going to cause some consequences that I kind of think is outrageous. Is that permissible? Like, establishing that element of this outrageous? Or is like the test literally just outrageous?
Well, obviously, typically what we're looking at is, could a reasonable jury say that this is way beyond the pale? And you would look at, like, well, what happened to give it some context. There are separate elements with separate focus, but it's not, they're not dissected so finely that you can't consider the actual impact. I mean, think about it, if you will, for a second, but compare it to the cases we already had, like the Dickens case, that's the one, Dickens before you're the guy who got shackled, beaten, and said, take your phone off the wall and leave. That, they even looked at even other conduct that wasn't even part of the IAD claim in order to figure out whether or not the conduct was outrageous. So it's not personal, finally. But if we think about it in context of that one, what do you think about it on this? Is it on the same plateau as Dickens? Was Dickens more outrageous, less outrageous?
Emotional distress there comes in the context of it being linked to some potential very severe physical harm. And obviously, in emotional distress claims, we don't need physical harm. If this is a freestanding claim, if we had physical harm, we'd be suing for the battery or whatever. This is a freestanding claim. But when it's associated with your fear of physical harm, one would expect it to be more outrageous than one where it's just a financial harm, even severe financial harm. So I think you're right. I think this one on the spectrum is clearly not the same level. But let's think about it in context with one that was a risk of, you know, financial harm. And that was the Nickerson case. Remember the woman with the pot of gold? All right. So it was a falsehood of, there's the pot of gold, and they had that whole ruse. And in the end, it ended up not being it. She went crazy. All right. So what do you think about it in context with that one? More outrageous, less outrageous?
I think it's, in this situation, it's less outrageous because in that situation, they knew she was prone to, like, mental, not disability, but she had suffered.
So they knew of her sensitivities?
Yes.
Okay. someone else more or less? Why? Yeah.
I think this one is the last because the other thing that we're even her friends and her family came on this joke.
Okay.
I think this is more outrageous. Kind of like losing their livelihood, their whole life, and stuff.
Okay.
It's not like a tree. But this is like their life.
Okay.
And then also they didn't know him at all, mm-hmm. which I think makes it more outrageous to do this to complete strangers, close to your family.
Yeah, you just emotionally stress them all over the place. Is there really the definition of family, those who cause emotional stress? No, I'm just kidding. But yes, all right, so I see, yeah, I see it. Yeah, when you look at the lack of relationship, it doesn't give context to what happens. Yeah. Yeah, I think the fact that this is really believable might make it maybe swing more towards it being outrageous because it's less likely that someone would be able to say, this isn't something I'm actually facing.
Mm-hmm. I would call it not outrageous in words. Not set a precedent. You know, lower the bar for something you shoot outrageous in love that plaintiffs recover on other tort actions and slander. We're going to start allowing for questionable. Motives, then maybe slippery slope, maybe a little bit too much, which will then increase lawsuits later on down the road.
Okay, so we definitely want to make sure that IAD doesn't become just like a, you know, backstop fill in the gap for everybody. I just want to make sure that we're clear. The only people who can recover here for the IAD are people who cannot sue in libel. That the people who sued in libel, they dismissed their IAD claims. So they cannot, under these facts, pursue their IAD claim. And that happens in a lot of jurisdictions where they say IAD is truly a gap filler. If you have something else, you can't use IAD. All right? Yeah?
Did you say they can't sue for IAD while they're also suing for libel, or they can't sue after they've already won a case for libel?
Either way. That once you have another tort for that claim, on these jurisdictions, it means that IAD is not a resort for you.
What if you fail your libel claim?
See, and that's the tricky part. And that's actually kind of what the casebook author raises here. And in operation, generally, no. So you've already had your claim dismissed. It's done. It's not like you can revive it. It's not like contingent to your success on libel. So the law setting up, if there's something that actually is a better fit, then that's the only one you're going to go with. Now, that's not every jurisdiction. Some do permit IAD in addition to other claims. But realize a lot of them don't like in the emotional distress claims themselves, the freestanding emotional distress, and will not permit those claims. So for the defendant who loses here and gets it dismissed, if he loses on a libel or slander claim, he's pretty much out of luck. Don't feel so bad for him because it's very, very hard to prevail on an IAD claim. It's not like the other person had this boon by getting the IAD claim. It's like all they had. It's all they got. And it was really down to a technicality of whether or not it was publicized to the Department of Health, which we'll get to in libel slander later. Pause momentarily. Let us muster and we'll deal with that one later. All right, but I think what we see here kind of percolating around the room is really the fact of why the court here sends it to the jury. I'll add one thing that I would probably distinguish the Nickerson case, the prodigal case from this one. There, the joke is purely for really bad laughs, and here it's actually you get some financial gain from it. And I do think, while we don't look to motivation, the fact that there's a profiting, like remember, it's for his career to make this study or for science or whatever he wants to label it in, I think in some way sets up for an argument that it's more outrageous, that you would utilize or capitalize on someone else's emotional distress in that way. But either way, the point is, it's enough to get to the jury. We have enough people disputing about whether it's outrageous or not. You get through this door. That's all. It's not that it is. It's not that it's not. Just enough to get by. All right? So that's how these work. The only other bit of stuff we need to get from the reading are the bystander claims. And really what I'm trying to get to is set you up for the
negligent infliction of emotional distress, where bystander claims become a real problem. So flip to 676, and here you're seeing the restatement's provisions on bystander claims. And they tell us, under 46, section 2, that where extreme and outrageous conduct is directed at somebody else, the defendant is subject to liability if he intentionally or recklessly causes severe emotional distress to a member of that somebody else's immediate family who was present at the time, or to any other person who's present at the time if such distress results in bodily harm. So if we break this down, and to give you some examples, what you're looking at is, I'm intentionally inflicting emotional distress towards person A, okay? So the defendant is directing this towards person A. Person A is not the person suing. It's plaintiff, okay? So they're not the one getting the direction. This isn't a claim. It's like the direction of the activity, the conduct is causing emotional distress to this guy. That's a plaintiff. So he's a bystander to it. Under the first subpart, you can recover if you're a member of A's family. Yeah. Sometimes they define it specifically by certain types of relationships. Here they say immediate family, so like let's assume like spouse, son, daughter, maybe brother, sister, and you're present. At time of defendant's conduct. So let's look at this first one as an example. Let's take the Dickens case. That's the, you know, I'm threatening you, take your phone off the wall, or leave or die case. All right, let's assume Dickens' wife was present in that farm barn. She herself would not have a direct IIED claim because they make no conduct that's extreme or outrageous to her person, or in any way threatening her own emotional state directly. But she has this bystander claim under the first section of the restatement because they did direct extreme and outrageous behavior that resulted in severe emotional stress. It was an IIED claim to her husband, and she was present during the beatings and witnesses the final threat. If under that situation she was there, she could recover as a bystander for IIED. Everyone understand that first permutation? It helps protect people who have a strong familial connection to the person who's being injured when they're there and able to observe this. Because it's kind of like you really should have known at that point that these people were also likely to have emotional stress. It's almost think about it like it's knowledge of substantial certainty. But not quite. So we have this kind of patchwork. You can also sue under bystander. Because if it truly was purpose with respect to the bystander, or knowledge of substantial certainty with respect to the bystander, we don't need any workaround. It would just be an IIED claim for that. She can't prevail traditionally, so she uses the restatement to prove it. Any questions on that at all?
Could you repeat the relationship?
You just, okay, you first have to focus on the defendant's conduct, the extreme and outrageous conduct, the IIED conduct, and see who is it focused on. So if we want to think about the Dickens versus Puryear, it was Dickens. Then we ask the plaintiff who's suing, does this person, plaintiff, have an immediate familial connection with Dickens? Yeah. Another statement is immediate family. Some jurisdictions have their own statutory framework for this, or common law framework that makes it even more close. But this is immediate family, so you're thinking like husband, wife, son, daughter, potentially brother, sister. It just depends, all right? Husband, wife, son, daughter, so yes. Anyone else? Probably not fit immediate. It just depends. All right, so if you can find that, like I said in my example, let's assume the wife was watching out. She fit his immediate family, and as long as she was present at the time of these threats, that final IIED threat and everything else, she could recover as a bystander. Right, the other variation is not one in which you have a kind of connection with this individual. So here, there's like no family connection, or to extent. Because if you find the family connection, you go under it, right? So it's just somebody else. And now, this person is present. at the time of defendant's conduct, and they suffer physical harm as a result of defendant's conduct. Realize it's still a derivative claim because they can't show that the defendant actually had an extreme or outrageous conduct that was either intentional or recklessly causing them severe emotional distress. They just happened to witness it, which is why we call it a bystander claim, and they're trying to say, I should still recover. And under this rule, you see the people who are not connected enough, and they're still present at the time they suffer physical harm. So let's take our Dickens example. Now, not one of the perpetrators, but someone else who just happened to be observing the beatings is watching them and suffers a heart attack. Okay? They have physical injury. They're present at the time. They can recover, even though they weren't being threatened. It wasn't being directed at them in any way. They just witnessed it, and it was an intentional infliction of emotional stress as to Dickens. They're present, and they suffer physical harm, not just emotional stress, not just like, wow, I feel anxious after watching that horrible beating, but some physical harm, then they can recover. So that's the two permutations.
They suffer physical harm as a result of the emotional stress.
As a result of the defendant's conduct. Now, if they had some sort of, like, physical injury, because let's say as they're beating him, the hammer or whatever they're beating with flings back and hits them, now they're back. They don't need it. So really, because they're having some emotional distress or anything else, they have nothing for.
I don't know if you said that. Do you have to have an IIED plan to get that?
Yes, because it's derivative.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're with them, they don't have that plan.
No, it's not that they have to win or prevail on their claim. It's that you, as the plaintiff, have to show that the person who is actually being directed at would have an IIED claim. No, they don't have to acquiesce to your lawsuit at all. Yes?
Just to clarify, so if you had a bystander who was family,
mm-hmm.
you would have to prove number one and number two against the person who was the defendant. But you would prove the severe emotional distress for the family, actually A.
Basically, all of this as to A. Yeah.
So you would have to prove severe emotional distress to A.
Yeah.
Before you can say severe emotional distress to you as a family.
Yeah, although the real dispute, I see what you're getting at. The real dispute isn't this as to A, because we're not trying to get recovery. Just saying that it does create severe emotional stress is generally enough to get over these claims. These are the two that you're more just generally disputing, but technically it's the whole thing. If they're not in the lawsuit, then we're not as worried about exactly what their injury is, like in the details, because they're not recovering damages. If they're in the lawsuit, then that's going to be litigated quite a lot. But it's really all of these against this person. And then now I derivatively have a claim because I fit this exception. Okay? It's derivative, meaning this claim has to be there against A. And then I can derive my claim if I fit these exceptions. Okay? It's not a freestanding claim, otherwise you'd be able to sue for this on your own. But you need this against A, or you don't have something to derive your own injury from, to derive liability. Yeah?
So is that all one lawsuit then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you may or may not join these other people. They don't have to join you, but in your lawsuit, this is part of the allegations. I'll tell you, though, for most bystanders, the problem is not this. It's demonstrating that they fit the exception. It could be this. I mean, they have to show this, but typically it's because they're now moving away from where their conduct is focused. And so this is the bigger issue, is why they're a bystander. You're going to see this doesn't happen so frequently. What normally is going to happen is negligent infliction of emotional stress with a bystander claim. And that's a totally different test. Yes. Okay.
Do you say that she could have a claim?
No, I changed the facts. Let's say that Dickens' wife was there while he was being beat. Nobody's wife was actually there.
Okay.
Even the defendant's wife had taken off.
Okay.
This is Dickens. His wife is watching.
Got it.
Any other questions on that at all? But you're right. You want to look at family relationship between plaintiff and the victim. That's where the relationship is. Or physical harm and no relationship that's still present. All right. Let's shift gears for a moment. We've got a little bit of time left in class today. And I just wanted to take the opportunity, if we had time, to get to a different kind of topic in class. And that is, you know, using some lawyering skills in the context of torts to see how this might arise. So I've already passed out some examples of retention letters. That's the first document. Like if you have a client, what you'd have them sign. One big important thing to note is the bottom, you know, it says subject to investigation. What you're basically telling them is, I've got to do some investigation before I truly agree to take on your case. But that's what this is. The other one is a release agreement. This authorizes when you talk to your client for you to then go get all their records that might be pertinent. And so that's all these are, just a kind of example. Obviously, they're not the best you could ever do. It's just examples of forms that you might want to use. So what we're going to spend a little time focusing on today is, let's say you meet a client, you know, and they, I'll give you a hint, there might be some intentional affliction, emotional stress going on, but like what kind of tactics you would take to get the foundation you need. So I'm pulling from a case that was out of Oregon in 1981. Actually, there's a lot of things in it, all of which you know. But one of them is going to be also intentional affliction, emotional stress. To show you how you use tactics to interview clients to build a torts case. So let's just talk about some of these tactics for a moment. I'll pass out the problem to you, and I'll play the client just so that you can practice a little bit with the technique. But I knew we'd have a little time, so I thought I'd try and bring this in. Okay, one standard form of interviewing techniques that you can use is called the funnel approach. And you'll get the rest of the picture. It goes down to a funnel. All right. But what you do is, initially, you let the client tell their story uninterrupted. And that they get a chance to just, you know, pretty much, it'll be free form, and you're just really listening. You're trying to give them a chance to get everything out. You know, clients don't know what's important. And sometimes by starting questioning them right away, you've actually missed relevant information that they don't know is relevant that you need to know. Right, so the beginning part of interviewing is really making sure that you sit back. Now you can't just be like, tell me your story, which is normally what happens with students. Start this process and things are running down lower to the hours, I'll tell you, I'll give you that question. I'll just be like, tell me what happened. You want to focus a little bit on, you know, helps me to know if you can start from the beginning of the day or the beginning of the event and give me the biggest picture you can. You know, tell me everything, whether you think it's important or not important. I just really want to understand a little bit about why you're here today and what brought you here. Okay? So direct them a little bit. Tell them to tell you everything. Otherwise, they'll hold back. You'll be surprised how much your clients will hold back from you. Sometimes intentionally, and sometimes, oftentimes, because they don't know what you're really looking for. And they'll think, oh, that's totally irrelevant. Also because, like, this particular claim, there's a lot of, like, sensitivity to it that you just don't want to go out and share with the entire world. So even though you're getting a lawyer that you'd like to have help you, you'd be surprised how much people will hold back because they find it embarrassing. And so you need to give them enough comfortableness to do that. So you need to step back, let them talk, and engage with them so that they know you're listening. After you do this, and sometimes you have to do it more than once, you then start narrowing your question base. So you're asking still not just tell me the specific answer, but open-ended questions. So like, what happened after this? Can you go back to the time where you told me this event? I'd like to hear a little bit more. Who was there? See how open-ended it is? It isn't like, tell me what so-and-so did. It's more open-ended. And that takes quite some time. You actually spend a lot of time in the open-ended questions. Right. If you want to think about a good client interview, you should be able to walk away and literally be able to draw a picture of everything that happened. You should know everything that happened. In fact, a lot of times when talking with people in injury cases, it is helpful to diagram things. If it's an accident, pull up a picture of the intersection so they can point to where things were. The more colorful, the more clear, the better story you get, the better you'll be able to represent your client. All right, and even to tell them, you know, it might seem like I keep going over this, but I want to make sure I understand exactly what happened to you. So I apologize for asking questions more than once. But because sometimes they also wonder when you're asking a question more than once, did you really want a different answer? What you don't want them to do is fudge it since they think you're fishing for something. You just tell them, I ask questions a lot because I want to make sure I fully understand. After you do this, then your last, before you leave with the client, at the conclusion of your interview is you want to confirm the facts that you've gotten from them. So if you think about it, it's like asking like detailed questions after you've gone in for this. All right, so I have a very short little video to demonstrate this for you, and then I'll give you the factual situation and have you do that right now. Have you kind of look over in groups, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we can come back to this a little bit on Monday. It's going to be long and dry. We'll kind of break this up a bit. We can do the actual questioning portion exercise there. So look at the video. We'll kind of get the initial story out to you. We'll do the initial part. And then you can come with your proposed more funnel questions, things you'd like to go for the open-ended ones, and then your more specific ones. So I'll pass this out as we're kind of watching. This video is actually talking about interviewing kids, but I'll tell you the technique is the same, shockingly enough. So interviewing a child and interviewing an adult, the only thing you worry more about with children is use of language, because they don't always understand the terms you use. Oops. So I show this a lot. I show this one a lot when I teach like child welfare classes. We're going to actually put that in the back row. There's some more here. Thank you. Make sure they get around. So excuse the fact that it's dealing with kids and realize that the portion I'm showing you is the exact same approach that you would use in questioning an adult. So let's just watch the video, I'll answer some questions for you, and then give you the instructions for what we do after this. Okay, so here we go.
And to develop facts in order to the case.
This is from the ADA.
Asking open-ended questions, letting the kid run with it, and then following
up
with narrow questions. And I find it to be extremely effective. In the first stage of the funnel technique, the lawyer allows the child to tell the story uninterrupted. In the second stage, the lawyer asks open-ended questions to further develop facts. In the third stage, the lawyer confirms facts through a series of narrow, close-ended questions. Here's an example of the first stage, where the lawyer allows his client to speak uninterrupted.
Okay, so I just want to tell you what this case is about so you can understand what the interruption is and the focusing. This child is part of foster care. In her foster care placement, she's accused of battering another child that's removed from that foster home. So she's in a delinquency proceeding that keeps representing her on battery. So it should fit right in with what you understand. It's just battery, but it's a juvenile criminal offense. All right, so this is the open-endedness. See how comfortable the lawyer has to be with just letting the client talk.
What happened when Oscar got hit?
There was one particular game we all wanted to play, which was called WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw the person in a body slam by throwing them onto the floor. And then, out of nowhere,
I let them tell me the story at least once, if not more times, all the way through without my asking any questions.
It shows the child that you're going to let them speak, that you're not going to cut them off, that you don't discredit their story because their job. But it also begins to reveal to you their view, where they're sitting in this whole narrative, in this whole story, their perspective on it, what's important to them.
Stage two of the funnel technique is your chance to track back through the story using open-ended questions, starting with who, what, where, when, why, and how, to clarify the story and continue to develop facts.
Okay. So, let's go over that again slowly so I can understand each part. When did it all start?
It was like a month ago. Me and my brother were staying with that foster mom, Deirdre. Mm-hmm. And you know we had seen a show on TV called WrestleMania.
Well, what's WrestleMania?
WrestleMania is when you throw the person in a body slam by throwing them onto the floor.
Tell me more about that. Does it hurt?
No, because we had put pillows down on top of the rug that was in the room. So when you fell down, it didn't really hurt that much. And we were all doing it to each other. I mean, Oscar was doing it too, so.
Yeah.
All right, so one thing I also want to point out, you know, notice he probably knows what WrestleMania is in the context of outside world. For he needs to ensure that he understands the client has the same perception. And I'll tell you, like, if you take adult interviewing and counseling, they call it the funnel technique, and it's the exact same thing. And I'll tell you that oftentimes with lawyers, especially when lawyers go astray, is that they believe that their client is coming to them like fully knowing everything that they need to tell them. You really have to make sure that you check what you're getting from them, that so that you understand the pictures, the same picture in your head is the same one that really happened to your client. So questioning on these kinds of things, like tell me what you mean by when you say, like for example, tell me what you mean by when you say the car was speeding. Like, you know, how fast? Did you look down your speedometer? You know, you're not asking them like to a kid, but you still have to make sure that you understand fully what they mean by the terms they're using. Because you'll start to now see a term and think, this is the tort I'm suing for, and forget they're talking in a vernacular that's not primed for the law. All right? So let's continue to listen. You'll see the more focused questions coming.
Shorty got mad because he said he had thrown him down to ride and picked up a bat, and he had hit Oscar with the bat. And that was it. The police came.
What did Shorty do with the bat?
He had poked Oscar in the stomach with it.
Poked?
Yeah, poked.
And what happened to Oscar?
Oscar sort of fell down holding his stomach crying.
Can you show me what Shorty did?
Yeah, he picked up a bat, so he threw me down so hard and he poked him in the stomach.
Open-ended questions just allow the child to tell you what's most important to him. What did the child notice and observe?
Stage 3 of the funnel technique takes place deeper into the client relationship. The lawyer has already heard each of the following facts from the child and is using narrow questions to reconfirm and clarify the facts that are most legally relevant to the case.
That's a different case.
Did they leave you in that room?
Yes.
Did they leave you in there for a long time?
This is about a police interrogation.
Yes.
How long?
It felt like forever. Maybe a few hours.
Did they feed you?
No.
All right, so you can imagine kind of what they're getting at. You know, they're trying to talk about, like, coercion and whether or not it was voluntarily given. I mean, all those things, even, like, if you think about false imprisonment, like how long were you confined, all those things. You know, all those kind of specific details are something you want to do. You don't want to jump too quick to it because you're going to cut out pieces that they might all of a sudden go, oh, yeah, it's all about this, and so I'm going to give you all this, and forget that. Oh, yeah, by the way, he slapped me on the way in. I forgot to mention that. And you'd be shocked at what people miss, and you'll see it come up. You work in court because all of a sudden on the stand someone's giving a story that they just didn't quite expect, or in deposition that'll happen. So you don't want that to happen. You want to know as much as possible. Where it slightly deviates between a child and an adult is that it's harder with the kids. Practicing law is much harder with kids, even though it's not as glamorous as practicing with adults, because the more you ask specific questions, the more likely you have the possibility of changing their version of events to where they can't recall what was accurate or not. So you actually destroy the actual recollection. So we have to be very good at knowing when to be narrow and knowing when to go back to open-ended so that they know and they trust you that you're not trying to drive to an answer. With an adult, you have a little bit more latitude about being able to go to those more narrow questions than you do with a child because you're not worried about that. All right, so since we're close to the end, we're going to stop with the video, and I'll just tell you the specifics or the generic story, and we can do this as part of our break time on Monday. All right? In this situation, the client, I just gave you very generic, she was a part-time employee at Kmart. What happened was she was checking out a customer, and the customer was upset because when she rang up a set of curtains, she said it's a sale price. She said no. She starts making a ruckus. The price check gets taken on. Manager comes over and goes, no, those in fact are not. The curtains are on sale. Customer leaves to go try and find sale curtains. In the meantime, the plaintiff here closes out that original sale, puts the merchandise over the side, and checks out other people. Customer comes back and says, hey, where's my stuff? She says, over there. Next thing she knows, the customer is throwing her arms up in the air and making a huge ruckus that she had taken some money from her. $5 bills. Right? And throws such a fit that the manager comes over and says, well, what do you want me to do about it? At that point, the manager turns out the employee's pockets, starts to look for the money, can't find it, zeroes out the register. It looks like it zeroes out correctly. Said, well, I'm sorry, she obviously didn't take the money. It's just denied. She took from you. Customer won't have it. They take the employee back to the female's restroom, have her disrobe in front of the customer. It's a real-life case. And I say, you know, she's down to her underwear, and I say, well, what else do you want us to do? Do you need us to take off her underwear, almost in jest? And the customer responds, no, because I can see through it. I know she doesn't have my money. They leave. Customer later goes home and realizes that the money was in her purse. Yeah. So anyway, that's the generic story. So if I was to give you the open-ended, like, to tell me why I'm here today, there's facts in there that you still need to learn. I haven't given you everything. I probably just gave you what a person would recount who had that happen to them. What I want you to do before class next week is think about what kind of questions would you ask that were more open-ended first to try and figure out what kind of torts you might be able to sue and whether or not she in fact has a claim. Because now you're going to counsel her about whether she does have a claim against this customer, against her employer. And the last question will be like, you know, what legal research would you do from here? But focus on the questions. We'll work that in sometime tomorrow, so we'll work a little bit of practicing lawyer skills and support. So that's what you really do on Monday. All right? See you Monday. Have a good weekend. Nice.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'll count it as one since it wasn't about your own, like something you couldn't control. Do you else need a handout from the exercise? Okay. Go ahead.
So
just listen to the podcast.
I guess. Yeah, you guys. You just